Ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege to welcome back to the Salia Report a man who needs no introduction, Junius Ricardo Stanton. He was just with us not that long ago, and when I kept watching events unfold in Baltimore, I said, okay, we're going to get Junius back. The divide and conquer is getting to me again. So, Junius, you're coming in from Philadelphia. Welcome back to the Salia Report.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, this, before we dive in and talk about what's been going on in Baltimore, I wanted to go back and revisit sort of the history of the inner city. And the more I looked at it and emailed with you about sort of what I wanted to include, I realized, you know, this is for you and me, this is a very personal story. I grew up at 48th and Larchwood in West Philadelphia. Where exactly did you grow up?
I grew up in the Germantown section, the West Mount Airy section on Charlotte Street, and it was a working-class neighborhood. Back then, it was the remnants of apartheid segregation, so our community contained just about anything. We had ministers. We had one was a police detective, blue-collar workers. We had a doctor on our block. There was a doctor around the corner. And so prior to the civil rights struggle, prior to the Open Fair Housing Act, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, everybody was lumped together. So community was stable. And I tell people, young people now, the one thing that separates the community from during my time with the communities in the inner city now is that every house had a man in it.
Right.
You know, whether
right, and it was funny because
my father died when I was three, but I had a great uncle. We had relatives, my great aunt, great uncle, their son lived there, and we had another cousin whose father lived in New York, but the son came to Philly and he stayed with us. So there was always a man in the house in every house on my block.
Right. Right, I remember it that way, and it was funny because I grew up in a neighborhood, you know, our neighborhood was a neighborhood of stoops, and every night everybody was out on the stoops talking to each other, and a lot of the games that the kids played revolved around the stoops, like stoop ball or, you know, blackjacks, and what was amazing was it was before anything that was politically correct, and we used to always be really... I would say very blunt, you know, because the Catholics and the Jews and the Protestants were always fighting, and the Italians and the Blacks, and we'd call each other all these names, and everybody was friends. You know, there wasn't these divides, but we were very blunt and honest, and there was a lot of, I don't know, there was just a lot of connection between people and between households. And, you know, I was always telling everybody that the neighborhood was run by the high-performance people. And you couldn't tell who, you know, they knew who each other were. They were the people who took responsibility and got things done. And, you know, but it was always like an 85-year-old Black grandmother and some intern from the local, you know, university school. And, you know, it was the people who took responsibility and they controlled the neighborhood because if somebody misbehaved, they could cut off their money. And, you know, and so the slugs weren't in charge. We had great slug management back then. And it was when all the government money came in and the drugs that, of course, the slugs got control of the neighborhood and it went down from there. But, I don't know. You know, it was a different time. The popsicle index was 100%.
Yeah, but in our neighborhood, the so-called criminal element, the only the criminal element that we saw was the numbers runner, and he was the guy. His sister lived up the street from me. His brother lived down the street, the next block. He had later on as his youngest sister lived around the corner. He lived on the block. But it wasn't the violence and the thuggery that is depicted now.
Right.
He was just a guy that came around and people gave him a quarter or a nickel or whatever, and he came around to pay when you hit.
Well, and he gave better returns than the lottery does today.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, he did. He did. That's been studied and proven. The numbers guys gave you better yield. Well, let's talk about what's happened, and let's go back even further, because the history of Baltimore, and this is true particularly of the East Coast ports, the history of Baltimore takes us back to slave trafficking. And one of the realities is if you look at the problems in the inner city, if you follow the money always goes back to pools of capital that were built during slave trafficking. And it's almost as though the slave trafficking, whether it's the pools of capital or the people who believe in slave trafficking, they never, you know, they never completely gave up on the philosophy. So let's start there.
Well, what I was thinking about this, it's karma, it's the boomerang effect. Baltimore commercially started off as a port to export tobacco in the beginning. And so as we know, tobacco is a highly addictive, it's an unhealthy substance. So now the boomerang is coming back, and we'll get to that, this part of it later, with the heroin traffic, only it's not being exported, it's being imported into Baltimore. So you had the slave traffic. Primarily, it was a drop-off point, Annapolis and Baltimore. In the 1800s, Baltimore was a port that brought in a lot of Africans and then shipped them to either New Orleans or through the shipping or overland into the Deep South and later with the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. And so when you talk about Baltimore and you talk about the history of Baltimore, one of the things that you have to look at is the slave pens or the slave trader jails. And they were there, and you can see the modern-day replica of that with central booking and the Baltimore City detention and the skyrocketing incarceration, not the prison incarceration, but the jail incarceration, people who are just waiting to go to trial. Is very reminiscent to the slave pens. The immigrant population that came in, the original Irish came, they had some capital, they had skills. With the potato blight, you have people who are traumatized. They're trying to get away from not only not being able to eat, but the political implications of how it happened and how the British were treating them in Ireland. They come, this wave has no skills, so they're competing with the free blacks that are there who by the 1840s and on were fairly numerous. Some accounts say that they were just as numerous as the free blacks as they in Charleston, because they worked as caulkers in the shipbuilding and they did a lot of the things around the port. And so you had that tension, people who were coming who were traumatized. You have the traumatized Africans, you have the traumatized Irish, you have the traumatized Germans who were coming in escape from the political situation that was going on in Germany in the 1840s on. And so you have these people coming into that area and they're bringing this trauma, the emotional trauma, this psychological trauma with them, and they're also coming into an environment that they're unfamiliar with, and they have to make their way, and often they have to make state their claims, state their peg out their property and locale. And of course the capital people could care less. You know, they're there to make money. They're there to use the port, they're there to use the railroads to ship commodities. Many of them were human beings, whether they were black or white. And so that is the tone and tenor that is the foundation of the city of Baltimore.
Right. So you're
we're just seeing generations of this cauldron bubbling now, and so you see somebody in custody who gets killed, and you think, oh wow, that's a shame, or well, he deserved it, he had it coming, whatever your perspective is, but it goes deeper than that.
Right. Because you're talking about not just decades, but centuries of a particular kind of lawlessness going on in this place.
Right.
Right. So let's
go ahead. Generations. And think, how would you feel if your people were starving and you had to relocate and you didn't know where you were coming? You had no, it's not like you're going to see grandma and they're going to take you in. You're coming to a brand new place and they're not necessarily welcoming or accommodating you. It's really rough for you.
Right.
And that was the Germans and the Irish. And of course, the blacks, the African situation was far worse in terms
right.
of how they were treated.
So let's move up into the post-World War II period, because it was then that the drugs started to come in. So on top of this situation, you start to bring narcotics, and of course the first place they start coming in is the ports. So
right.
it's the end of World War II, and the black budget is beginning to really kick in. The drugs are coming in. What happens? What happens in these places?
Well, the drugs come in, and at that point, they're controlled by the CIA and the Cosa Nostra. They were in partnership, for the most part, for drug running in this country. And so the drugs come in, and they filter them into the black community, and for the most part, they're totally controlled by the Cosa Nostra. It's not until later in the 60s that, the late 50s and the 60s, that blacks start to get a little piece of the action.
Right.
So when we look at what's happening in Baltimore now with the heroin epidemic that was not discussed at all during the riot or this whole piece, but is shown bigger than life in the HBO series The Wire, you're talking about multi-generations of heroin use coupled with the deindustrialization of the city of Baltimore. So you're going from a port town, you're going from an industrial town, you're going from a railroad hub, to the point where unemployment is skyrocketing, poverty is on the rise, and what I call maladaptive pathologies are the norm. And so this is the social milieu for a lot of people in Baltimore, black and white.
Right. I remember, I don't know if you remember when I brought Paul Atkinson to meet you.
Right.
Paul had been the president of the biggest shipyard, Sun Shipbuilding in Philadelphia. And at the end of World War II, they were outside the government, they were the largest employer in Philadelphia. And you had a huge, thriving shipyard in Chester, Pennsylvania that created, you know, not just an enormous number of jobs in Sun Shipbuilding, but you can imagine all the retail and other businesses that spun out of that. And he was part of a QTAM action because it was really sort of taken apart by black budget fraud, and the whole business essentially, you know, the shipbuilding business moved abroad. And it was Paul who taught me, you know, it wasn't economic. It didn't go abroad for economic reasons. It went abroad for political reasons. But as a result, you see the entire devastation of the community. And one of the reasons we're going to talk about The Wire, because I think The Wire is, I don't know how Simon managed to get it on TV, but thank God he did. But what you see is what happens when you deindustrialize a city and the devastation that it brings. But I think that's very important and very powerful. And I don't think that the industrialization was just an economic phenomena. I think there was a very intentional political decision. And that's what Paul's experience in Sun Shipbuilding really taught me, is that, you know, a decision was made to move the jobs and the businesses out. You know, but that had enormous repercussions. And then you move the businesses out and you move the drugs in. Well, you know, when you kill people's income and then overwhelm them with drugs, you know, you get quite a mess.
Right. Now, remember he talked about Chester, but the same thing that happened in Chester happened in Camden, happened in Philadelphia, and to a lesser extent, Trenton, because it was all part of that Delaware River corridor.
Right.
That navigation corridor. And so that's what happened in Baltimore.
Right. Right. And the other thing that happened with the drugs is you brought the mortgage fraud in. And I've written and studied a lot about what happened with the mortgage fraud. But Baltimore was hit particularly hard. You know, and I saw that when I worked at the FHA, and then when we worked as their investment advisor, the amount of foreclosure and churning of the FHA portfolio in Baltimore was extraordinary. And of course, that was a very big business, and it went hand in glove with the narcotics trafficking.
Yeah, and even today as we speak, Baltimore is one of the top cities in terms of foreclosures in the country.
Right.
So
right.
Still ripping out.
Okay, so the other thing I have to bring up is prisons. Because, of course, what happened in the 90s was a decision was made to, you know, if we're going to be a global empire, then we need a global prison system, and we need private prisons. And, of course, it all started with a dramatic increase in mandatory sentencing and other things that exploded the private prison population. And there's no doubt that Baltimore was one of the targeted cities for that, particularly in the early years. So I don't know what the incarceration rates are, but I know they're high.
No, they're astronomical. But even before that, I wanted to remind you about the whole COINTELPRO in the 60s and 70s.
Oh, right. How could we forget COINTELPRO?
And the reason that's important, because they went after any dissidents, no matter what color they were, but also...
Right.
Primarily in the black community, any type of progressive leadership was either co-opted or eliminated. And so the resistance or the resilience in leadership, or as I heard someone use the term consequential leadership, you don't have that in Baltimore. I mean, you have leaders, but you don't have the type of leaders that you had in the late 50s and 60s that were taking on American apartheid and American political oppression.
Right.
It's more accommodationist type leadership now.
Right. I went back and studied the COINTELPRO process and came to the conclusion, in terms of poisonings, assassinations, legal and financial targeting, you know, basically leaders were targeted in many, many ways, in a way that was never really sort of identified and understood. And, you know, part of it was you had a whole series of leaders in the 60s assassinated in broad daylight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or intimidation. For example, now, I was not raised in Baltimore, so I can't use any experiences there. The experiences in Philadelphia, say, what the police did to the Black Panther Party, where they raided their office on Ridge Avenue, brought them out, stripped them naked, and allowed the media to see that. In addition to, what happened to MOVE, because that's
right.
All part of that. So you're talking about poison. You're talking about destroying people's reputations. You're talking about frame-ups. You're talking about the police brutality. You're talking about the judicial system running amok. And just this sheer intimidation. Then on top of that, you bring in the drug. And so those leaders who would stand up and say no, or who would galvanize the community and work to find some way to resolve some of this situation, they're gone.
Right.
And part of it had to do, I know, looking at my neighborhood, when black folks who had more economic means had an opportunity to leave that neighborhood. And like I said, it was a working class neighborhood. They did. Dr. Harris and his family left. Mr. Alexander and his family left. They didn't move that far, but they left. He was a police detective. And so you had the people that you talked about who were the movers and shakers in the community. May not have had a title, but they asserted themselves. A lot of them left. And in that vacuum came some other people that did not have the best interests of the community at heart.
Right. What happened to us was, if you looked at the people who controlled the neighborhood, you know, they had 100% intelligence of what was going on, and they had the ability to informally enforce against somebody who was behaving badly. You know, so they had a kind of they had authority and control. Once all the government money came in and the drugs, you had all these sort of, I call them the slugs, the net energy minus people. They could get, you know, they could get either police or government protection, and they could get money, and there was nothing the good guys could do to enforce against them. And the problem was that you had, you know, most of the people are busy, they don't want to be inconvenienced, and so they start saying what the slugs, you know, they start following the slugs around because they're afraid of them. And then you get the wrong people controlling the neighborhood.
Yeah. And the other thing, it goes back to what I talked about, where you had a male presence, I mean a real male presence.
Right.
The stand kind of guys who would support their wives and support the older people who kept watch of the community during the day.
Right.
You had a change in the laws. The divorce laws became more lenient. Catholic Church backed down on its staunch anti-divorce policy. And then you had the welfare, which said in order to get aid to dependent children, you cannot have a man in the home. So all of that conspired to drive away the male presence. Then you take away the employment. You take away the,
right.
the industrial base of a town, of a community. Then you bring in the drugs, then you bring in the unsavory characters, and then you begin to promote the antithesis of the type of community that you had. I mean, to a large extent, television and the film in the 50s was unrealistic, and we all know that. But at least they had censors and they had a focus that kept the myth of America going. But then in the 60s and 70s, you had the anti-hero. And once that came in and they built on it generation after generation, so now you have what we have, you know, the so-called reality shows where crime, incivility, disrespect, that they're the norm and they're glorified and they're rewarded because people get those shows and they get paid.
Well, the media, you know, my experience was the media – as the drugs came in and more the mortgage fraud came in, the media's job was to persuade people that everything going wrong in that neighborhood was caused by the people who lived in that neighborhood.
Right.
So I'm a hardworking homeowner. I've got a small business. I got the CIA dealing drugs and trying to entrap my children with drugs. And I've got, you know, the local government steering government contracts to large companies are coming in and putting me out of business. And I got mortgage fraud going on next door, which is destroying the value of my house, which is being promoted by, you know, HUD and the intelligence agencies. And then I turn on the TV and I'm told that this is because I have bad morals, you know, and I'm taking on, you know, in other words, the drugs, the mortgage defaults, those are all my fault and my bad behavior.
Right.
I'm inferior. And it's like the media was the ultimate, in a funny kind of way, the media was the worst part of the hit.
Yeah, because they began, not only is it your fault, but they began to criminalize the effects, not the causes.
Right.
Not the fraud, not the collusion between the police and the drug dealers, but the flight of the responsible people from the community, the efforts on their part to just to make it day to day, they became the scapegoats. And we saw
right.
that in 2008 where they blamed poor people, essentially, or people who were trying to live the American dream for the housing collapse.
Right. And it gets even worse because so we make money on the mortgage fraud. We make money on the drugs. We take a small percentage of that and we invest it in foundations that do good works in the community. And so I take a little bit of the money I made destroying your business and selling drugs to your kids, and I bring it back in and make an investment in low-income housing and have a photo op where, you know, I get one of your kids standing up and sucking up to me and thanking me for everything I'm doing for the community, and I'm the good guy.
Right.
So it's...
Also, behind the scenes, you're also working on ways to acquire more property in the neighborhood.
Right.
So it's not just the bogus photo op. It's a business deal where you're scheming on some of the properties in that area.
Right. So it's a leverage buyout. I'm using the profits I make destroying the neighborhood to buy it up cheap because I got the prices low now.
Right.
Right.
And then
so,
you'll turn around and then develop it or you're seeing that, and you heard that in Baltimore where the people complain about regentrification. They're upset
right.
because they don't have the funds to fix their homes up. Their homes are decreasing in value, and then the speculators are coming in and buying up the property or holding it so that no development takes place. And there are massive swaths of abandoned homes, which were depicted in The Wire. If you go to Baltimore, you see it. It wasn't a lot, some Hollywood lot that they constructed. That's the reality on the ground.
Right.
And
there's a story I have to tell you.
Huh?
There's a story I have to tell you in the 1998, you know, we were working on REITs and venture funds for communities so that they could circulate capital, you know, and you know, build the equivalent of internal stock markets for places. And I got asked out to lunch by the council to one of the authorizing committees in Congress, and they said, look, we just want to let you know that no equity capital will be allowed to circulate in these communities except that come through the low-income housing tax credits through Enterprise and LISC. It's the only equity that will be allowed to flow into real estate in these communities. It will not be permitted. And I said, oh, you know, so the only guys who can do development other than, you know, private investors who are making money on the drugs is not-for-profits. So the only participation that anybody in that community will be able to have is with a not-for-profit developer. No one will be allowed to build equity, period.
But even with that, if Baltimore was like Philadelphia, the paperwork was massive. It took, I think when I was in school, I was at Penn at the planning school, and I was working in the Model Cities area. Zor, United African American, African Methodist Church, wanted to build a housing, a senior citizen. It took years for them to get that done.
Right.
You know, so even the people who had the best intentions, because they couldn't get the credit, they couldn't get the funding, it took years, and I think they probably hoped that they would become discouraged and give up.
Oh, that was always the plan. I you know my Heritage Foundation story. Do you remember that?
Mm-mm.
I was Assistant Secretary of Housing.
Sure. And Kemp, remember, but go ahead.
Kemp went up to New York and with Charlie Rangel and made some promise in Harlem and came back, and you know, every time they would come back they would list what they promised to do, and then it was our job to implement. So he promised some kind of, I think it was 202 housing, the same kind of housing you're talking about up in Harlem. And so I'm implementing away, and somebody called me up and said, you know, you've got a problem with the Heritage Foundation. I said, really? Why is that? And they said, well, you got a big problem. I said, well, let's have them over to dinner. So I had a little dinner party, and a group of them came over, and they said, we got a problem because you're implementing this 202 housing in Harlem. I said, well, you know, the secretary went up and with Charlie Rangel at a press conference promised that, you know, and I'm just doing what I'm told. I mean, I'm just implementing what he promised. And they said, well, no, you know, he promises that, but you're supposed to bollocks it up in the bureaucracy and make sure it never happens. And I said, well, wait a minute, he promised it. And they said, no, that's so that white women in Westchester who see the clip on TV think that we're caring, but we don't want to waste any real money on that. You're supposed to bollocks it up. I said, well, I'm not, you know, unless I get an order from the secretary, I'm going to go ahead and implement it. So I was in big trouble with the Heritage Foundation.
Why they did to you what they did to you.
Well, but, you know, here's the interesting thing. You know, complexity and bureaucracy and gridlock was a plan, because what you did was, I'll tell you how it worked. If you had $25 million of insurance that you could do for multifamily insurance, or let's say, I forget what the number was, but let's say you were going to do $5 billion a year, and the, you know, because you were charging a price that was below the market price because it was government guaranteed, you know, and government subsidized, you get $25 billion of demand for $5 billion. So you had three options. One is you could very clearly state your policy goals, and then the $5 billion would get the ones that fit the policy goal. The second was you can just give it to your pals, but of course then it's too obvious. But the third is you can just gridlock everything and then make sure that the right lawyers know how to process the $5 billion for your friends, the ones who donate for the campaign. And so number three was the policy you used, and gridlock was necessary to slow down and stop the $20 billion that you weren't going to fund. And then you just say, oh, well, you know, the stupid bureaucrats.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah.
I remember once. Go ahead.
That's the game that they play. And, you know, there's a saying, by the time the fool learns the rules of the game, the game is over. And
right.
So many of the grassroots people who really had the best interests of the community at heart never really got through the legalese or never got through the red tape. That just kept them at bay.
Right. They kept, you know something? They wanted to feel included, and if they were included in the process, they felt included, and that's what they got. They got a feeling of inclusion. They never got any money.
Right, and they could go back and tell their constituents, we are meeting, this is what is happening, this is what's promised, and we're working on it.
Right, and it's really very complicated. And, well, you saw, anyway, so I had one friend who used to call it the beatdown. And, you know, what you were seeing in these places, you were seeing a beatdown from so many different directions. And, of course, if you lived in Greenwich, Connecticut and didn't grow up in it, it was very hard to understand, you know, what it was like and what it was like to live inside of that. And when The Wire came along, I couldn't get over it. Because The Wire for those who haven't seen it, it was a TV show. It ran for 5 seasons. And The Wire really took you from the street level all the way up through the police. And you really saw how the whole ecosystem worked down on the ground. And I don't know if you ever saw, there was a Canadian production called it, Intelligence, that took you from the police level up into the intelligence agency level. And finally, in the third season, they started to mess with the Carlisle group and they shut him down in the middle of the season. But you really, maybe if you could talk a little bit about The Wire and what it was and why it had such an amazing impact.
Well, David Simons was a newspaper reporter, a lifelong newspaper reporter. I believe he worked for the Baltimore Sun. And so he had an intimate view of the city of Baltimore on every level. And he became a screenwriter. And I believe that he was associated with Homicide, Life on the Streets. And that's another show I wanted to talk to you about. It was set in Baltimore, and it followed a homicide squad in their work, their day-to-day work, dealing with catching cases and working through them, and whether they were the serial killers or whether they were just the Saturday night fight in a bar or whatever. And so his understanding of Baltimore, each season he looked at another aspect of the puzzle. So he looked at the drug traffic because that is a significant reality in that city. So that
right.
first season, you see the Barksdales, you see the police, you see the dysfunction in the police, and you see a group of misfits coming together to form a squad to take on the Barksdales and or their competitors and that whole piece. The next year, they look at the port. They look at the drugs coming in. They look at it from the first season is primarily focusing on the African American community. The squad is a mixed squad. It's almost like real in terms of the characters that are in the squad. The next year, they focus on the port. Like we talked about the port,
right.
They brought all of this in about the drugs, the connected, the guys later on in later series, they call it later in several seasons, they call it the connect, the Greek guy that is running the drugs. The third season, I think they talked about the schools. I think that was the third or fourth season. No, the third season they got back on the Barksdales, and you see them what happens to them, that family and that group, that gang is supplanted by another gang. The fourth season they talk about the schools, and they also talk about the politics. And this was really a reflection that the guy who was a councilman who ran for mayor, and at the end of the series, he becomes governor. I think he was the O'Malley. His character and his thing was based on O'Malley, who became the mayor of Baltimore and later became the governor. And so Mr. Simon was right on. I mean, it was gritty. It was real, shot in the city. It wasn't pretty. And it talked about corruption, it talked about gridlock, it talked about just apathy, it talked about the malaise, the drug culture, put the beat down of the drug culture of the addiction And you see it through the eyes of the police. You see it through the eyes of the gangsters. You see it through the eyes of the people who OD, the people, you know, I think Bubs, the one guy, he got his life together. The one drug, he got his life together. You see it through the lives of the reporters and the politicians. And it was very real life. It was based on facts. It was based on Mr. Simon's experience, his knowledge of the city. And I probably threw people for a loop because they probably couldn't believe that that's how a major metropolitan area worked.
Right.
And he didn't even cover the issues about they did show the jail. They showed when one of the Barksdales went to prison. But they didn't even show the issues that we just saw in terms of the jails, that whole the issue about the jails, the overcrowded jail. And so The Wire, prior to The Wire, he did a show called The Corner, where he just looked at one neighborhood, one particular corner, the kids, the drug addict mother, the comings and goings on the corner. I couldn't watch. It was too, and I was still working then. I was a probation officer in Philly, and it just sent chills and shudders down just to watch that, because I saw that in the Badlands. It was almost the exact thing that I was seeing in my job, on my job. So I couldn't watch it. But The Wire was really a deep program. And I felt they were cheated. They should have won more Emmys than they, because I don't think they won any.
Well, it's, you know, it's hard when you're telling the truth. And I think the hard part for me about watching The Wire or watching the whole situation is when you're living in a neighborhood, and I grew up in one of those neighborhoods, when you're living in a neighborhood like that, what you're watching and what you're dealing with is corruption on almost every front. There's nothing healthy to connect into. There's nothing healthy to be inspired by. There's nothing healthy to give you energy. You're just dealing, you know, every time you turn around, you're getting hit with, because when the police, when the enforcement, when the, you know, the courthouse, when the city hall, you know, when they're all on the take, you know, how do you navigate a system like that, particularly if you don't have any resources? I had to navigate that system. It took me 11 years and $6 million, and I'm alive because I had $6 million to spend. How do you do it when you have nothing?
Well, that becomes the challenge, and that's why I said the psychological malaise. If you go to Baltimore, you see it. Now, most people go to Baltimore, they'll go to the Inner Harbor, and that's where a lot of the private public resources were funneled to build that up. But those depictions that we saw a month ago in Baltimore, if you took away if you ran some of The Wire scenes right next to them, you couldn't tell the difference because it was so real.
Right.
The only thing was not there, they couldn't replicate the psychological depression and malaise that is in that town. And I thought to myself, when I was in went to New Orleans in 2013, and then I was there a couple of years, then I was there last summer, you can still see the effects of Katrina in New Orleans, just the beat down, the psychological beat down. And so that's what you're talking about, where the hopelessness, the feeling of powerlessness, the frustration. That's what we saw part of what you saw during the riot. Now, there were other forces at work there, and we maybe get a chance to talk about some of those, but the beatdown, the psychological beatdown is real.
Well, there are a couple things I want to talk about, and then I want to come back to the beatdown. One is, my reading of American history is that most, if not all, of the riots, for example, in the 60s, were essentially triggered by covert ops. So what I was told was in the late 60s, they cut off the drugs. You know, so they cut off the drugs, they cut off the money, and then they have covert ops sort of instigate and inspire the riots. So what you're watching is not necessarily a spontaneous event by people who really live in that place.
No, well, some of it was the cutoff of the drugs, but some of it was that's just the day-to-day frustration.
Right.
Listen to this. The appearance that the system is so corrupt and so insular that no one listens to my plea. And so the young man who was killed, Freddie Gray, was not the real cause of the riot in Baltimore.
Right.
You know,
right.
The situation with Michael Brown was not the cause of the situation in Ferguson. And you have to understand that both of those situations were brought on partially by outside agitation later, but initially because they live in a police state.
Right. And
they were doing what they call aggressive policing. They took on the Giuliani model, stop and frisk, stop and search. In Ferguson, the police were fundraisers, in other words, putting citations on people to raise money for that town. In Baltimore, because of the jail situation and because of the aggressive policing, a lot of kids were afraid of contact with the police, so that's why he ran.
Right.
So now he had a record. He might have, but if he did, he didn't want to be frisked, stopped, and then who knows? He might have had an open warrant, or he might have had a citation, or whatever. But he did not want to go to central booking.
Well, before I want to turn to the Baltimore riots, but before I do, there are two more things I want to just bring up. Have you ever read The Slaughter of Cities by E. Michael Jones?
Mm-mm.
It's a remarkable book about how the sort of Protestant elites use the HUD programs to manipulate the populations, particularly in the inner cities, in a way that sort of checkmated the growth of the Catholic Church. It's quite interesting if you want to get into some of the history here and the nuts and bolts of how it was engineered. So I just wanted to bring that up. The other thing I wanted to bring up on the beatdown is one of the reasons I think it is so important for everyone listening to this call to study what has been happening in terms of the sort of beatdown of the psychological health and the spiritual health of people in these neighborhoods. Is all of those techniques are now moving out to the general population.
Yeah. I was going to say before, you know, when we talk about Baltimore as a hub for the drug trafficking, this drug trafficking has been going on for quite a while.
Right.
Baltimore epicenter, but Maryland as a whole is feeling the brunt of it. This heroin is coming in from South America. It's purer than and more potent than the drugs that are coming in from Mexico and Asia. And so that's why it's having a devastating impact. And when you're looking at the statistics in Maryland, yes, you see Baltimore. Yes, you see the beatdown. But what you are starting to see is the rise of heroin addiction because it's cheaper, and most of the first-time users are white kids in their 20s.
That doesn't surprise me.
You know, the demographic, they're not all trailer park. You're talking about students, young professionals, because according to what's going on and looking at the research, the new heroin that's coming in is cheaper than the OxyContin and some of the pharmaceuticals that are popular in the outlying community. And so now you're getting young people who are not inner city dwellers hooked on heroin. And, you know, even in The Wire, the second season, when they talked about the port, you saw it, but the main people in that particular season were the white kids and the white union people that ran the Port of Baltimore.
Right.
And that's what you're seeing, but you're not seeing in today's reality the influence of the heroin be outside of Baltimore into Maryland proper. And if your listeners want to glean what's going on, have them do some research on that. Now, yes, it's bad in Baltimore, but it's also bad in Maryland.
Well, I was talking to somebody who is a landlord in a town with a university that's very top-notch not that long ago. And he said, you know, 10 years ago when I talked to the kids, they had a job. You know, on graduation, they had a job and they had a future and they had a plan and they were all excited about it. And he said 5 years ago, they were struggling to get the job, but they had a plan and they knew they were going to get a job and they were going to do whatever it takes. He said now they're graduating. Now, remember, this is a first-rate university. They don't have a job, they don't have a plan, and they're just going to go, like, keep waitressing and live.
Yeah, and they're coming out in debt.
That's right.
Not being
big debt.
Given file bankruptcy because they can't file bankruptcy for student debt.
Right. So there's a kind of hopelessness and a lack of ambition that never existed before.
Right.
And it's,
that's what we're seeing where this is. But think in terms of two generations, talking about 40 years from now. That,
right.
My friend Paul, the gentleman you introduced me to, he was talking about at the mid-60s, right, when they did the beat down on Chester, Sunset,
right,
and Camden. And that was in the 60s. Now here we are in going into the middle of the past, the middle, in the second decade of the 21st century. So
okay, so let's
generations of that in the inner,
right,
cities or cities like Chester, Baltimore, Camden, Philadelphia, and now it's starting to ripple out into the suburbs.
Okay, so now let's come to what just happened in Baltimore. So we come to Baltimore, and we've got a situation where everybody who lives within the city limits knows that the White House, the State House, the courthouse, and the police are functioning within a system which is, if you will, the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Right.
So the Sheriff of Nottingham is running the courts and enforcement in Baltimore, and they're making money, whether it's on the drugs, the mortgage fraud, or whatever. And everybody knows it. They're clear. So let's start with what happened with Freddie Gray.
Well, Freddie Gray was on a corner that now is being told that Marilyn Mosby told the police to target the drug activity that was in that area, in that neighborhood. So he was on that corner when he was spotted by the police. And he has an altercation with them, some kind of verbal conversation or whatever, and the two bicycle police come and they take him down, they handcuff him, they put him in a wagon. Now, the videos show that his legs are dangling, so he does not get in the wagon under his own mobility and his own power. By protocol, unless there's another call, the police are supposed to take the prisoner to central booking for processing. They don't do that. When they make a stop or if there's another meeting with some other police officers, there's people suspect that he took what they call a nickel ride or he took a rough ride, and that's when they throw you in the paddy wagon, handcuffed, you sit there, you're not restrained, you're not secure, and the driver makes sharp turns, stops abruptly, so you get banged around in the back of the paddy wagon. So that's...
So I call that diesel therapy.
Yeah, vehicle therapy, yeah. Yeah.
Diesel therapy.
Yeah. You know, yeah. And so
right.
He's not responsive. They don't call the EMTs. And when he goes, they see that he's injured. And so they take him to the hospital. He stays on life support and all that for about a week or so. And then he expires. Well, that kind of stuff happens all the time. So that wasn't the impetus for the riot. What we do know is that that there was a call for a purge that was supposed to take place on Monday, excuse me, at 3 p.m. It was directed at a lot of young people. From what I've seen from the community response, the young people weren't having any of it. But what happened was that at the mall, the police, there's a subway stop there and there's a bus stop there. The school that's near there is a magnet school, and so it draws young people from all over the city. So it's not wasn't a neighborhood school where the kids could just walk home. The police shut down the subway stop and they shut down the bus stop, and I don't think that there were any buses that they bused the kids throughout the city. And from what I have learned, the parents couldn't get there to pick the kids up. So the kids are milling around, walking, they're trying to get home the best way they can. The police pushed them, not physically per se, but they're in their phalanx positions and they prevent them from going in the mall, and they force them down toward what would later become the epicenter of the riot. So the people are upset about that. The police and the security people could never trace the source of the call for the purge to any person or any organization. Then the other...
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of rumors that there was, first of all, a lot of social media accounts involved in Ferguson that were also involved in Baltimore, and that included the social media campaign to organize a purge at the mall.
But supposedly they can't trace it to any account, any individual account or a corporate or collective account. Now, we don't know how true that is. Like I said, it was, if you look at any response by the residents of Baltimore, they weren't shocked by what happened to Freddie Gray.
And right.
They were upset. It wasn't like, well, okay, we're going to tear up the neighborhood. There's the narrative that the mainstream media has is the police versus the lawless thugs and savages. Well, the narrative for many of the people in the community is, well, why did the police do that to our children? And the other thing is, on a daily basis, they view, because of the aggressive policing, because of the excessive force, because of the history of Baltimore paying out so much money in legal fees and payouts to citizens in the last couple of years, they view the police as a hostile force in their community.
Right.
And it has nothing to do with race.
Right.
Because the Baltimore police leadership is over half people of color, blacks and Hispanics.
Right.
The blacks make up a significant percentage, almost half of the police department. The six officers, three of them were black that were indicted.
Right.
So it's not strictly a color issue. It's a system issue. It's a consciousness issue. It's a priority issue. And so the narrative is, well, these people just wanted to riot. They just wanted to take advantage of this situation. It wasn't like Freddie Gray was a national hero. Yes, people did go to his funeral, but it was not something that was that big a deal.
Right.
The police claim that they got intelligence about the gangs were going to target police officers. So you're talking about the three biggest, largest gangs, the Crips, the Bloods, and there's another group that are they tend to be older, and they're in the prisons, like the I think it's called the Black Gorilla something. That was the call for the police to be alarmed. Okay, and they said it was a credible source, but they didn't say who said it or where they got it from. The other side of the coin is that when the disturbances started, it was the Nation of Islam, some responsible people, some clergy folks, as well as some of these very gang members who tried to bring order and calm when things got out of hand. So, but that's not covered in the corporate media.
Right.
That's not something that the people.
Well, didn't the Bloods and the Crips have a press conference together saying they were trying to stop this? They weren't,
yeah.
You know, they weren't rioting. They were trying to stop the rioting.
Mm-hmm. But
you almost feel like the local guys. You almost feel like the local guys are now sufficiently hip to the game that they're. It's like the local immune system was much stronger in Baltimore than traditionally.
Yeah, and what we're seeing is that the traditional quote unquote leadership was out to lunch, and you had just like the young people in Ferguson, and they didn't want to hear anything from the professional leaders like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. These young people and these what I call the responsible on the ground people, some of the clergymen, some of the older folks, did not buy into what was going on, just like the kids didn't buy into the purge, the call for the purge.
Right.
So that is something that has to be examined further. Who put that call out? What happened with the police? Because the police claimed they were told to stand down. They were told, and they even have a clip of the mayor saying that she wanted to give people the space so if they wanted to act crazy, I forgot what her exact terminology, they could. But what she really meant was just she did not want a repeat of what we saw in Ferguson, which was a militarized overreaction. Now, she made some egregious mistakes, and her administration will probably have to pay for some of those. But there are other questions about it. You know, again, we're talking about, and that's one of the things I want to talk about, you're talking about the absence of a righteous leadership. A lot of the leaders in Baltimore, even though they're Black, come from a history. They're longtime connects with the Democratic Party and with Rollins' father.
Yeah, they're on the take.
Yeah, it was a long time.
That's what I saw in the 90s. You had the Black leadership on the take, you know, and they were lining up to get the contracts and the goodies as they supported, you know, a private prison policy that, as far as I was concerned, was, you know, it was, we were doing exactly what the Nazis were doing. It was slave labor. We were building and operating slave labor camps. We were dropping enforcement teams up to round up innocent people. They pulled the money on the public defender's office, so the kids all had to cop a plea. I mean, it was a scam. And the Black leadership was all there on the dole, you know, helping. It was bad. Yep.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons you pointed out that the on-the-ground folks are hip to that game.
Right.
And so a lot of them don't have credibility. Even though Mosley indicted or filed charges against the officers, as we speak, within their department, they're trying to sabotage that whole thing. So I'd be surprised that it goes to trial. Or if it does, they're going to have some procedural problems, and the officers will get off even if they don't get a change of venue.
One of the reasons I bring this up is I saw a lot of there was a lot of closeness in the shenanigans going on in Washington with what was going on in Maryland and Baltimore under the Clinton administration. And right after the riots, you have Hillary Clinton come out with an announcement of a huge overhaul of crime policies. As a big part of her campaign. So this is a big deal. And she makes a big speech at Columbia, and it completely falls flat. You know, if you look at the video, there's a lot of empty seats. And, it looked to me like her speech and the policy she was promoting was all planned before the riots. You know, it was part of the same plan is what I believe. But it didn't go. It didn't play. It didn't work.
No, because people are aware, even though a lot of the black leadership is wedded to the Democratic Party, a lot of other people know that the Clintons were involved in the welfare reform that put a lot of people in a bad place. They were part of some of the crime laws that aggravated the war on crime situation during his administration with the disparities, the sentencing disparities. And so people are aware of that. And so she is really going to have a credibility problem.
Right.
When it comes to, because they know that she's super rich. How can she come and talk to people who have experienced the American beatdown and try to make it connect and empathize with them? You know,
because she made her money engineering the beatdown.
Right, right. And right. People know that.
Well, it's interesting when
ability is limited, but they have the money to just to force it on people. Just like you said, the politicians
right.
will go along and they'll buy into it. Because they paid.
Well, it was interesting when the welfare reform bill happened, we were, we had built very deep databases on the housing stock in the U.S. and the HUD housing stock. And what you saw when you really unpacked the data was that a very significant number of people in the HUD assisted housing were on welfare. And we were trying, we were working on a couple of things. One was we were trying to get the laws passed that would allow somebody living in HUD housing to start a business, because you weren't allowed to start a business if you lived in HUD housing in your home, which is if mm-hmm. you're getting pulled off of welfare, you're going to have to start a business, you know what I mean? That was number one. But number two, if you looked at the laws for Section 8 housing, you had to be able to, if people were going to get thrown out of the housing, you had to provide vouchers and take all sorts of steps to make sure they were okay. And so if all those people were going to lose welfare while they're in your housing, there was a whole series of things you had to do, whether it was vouchers or other support services, to make sure you address the situation honestly. And one of the big fights in 1996 is we were ordered to rig the assumptions on the budget preparation, and we refused. We refused to do it, one, because if you turned in a false budget to OMB and they said, oh, well, Hamilton Securities blessed these assumptions, then it was going to sail through. And I had a big fight with the guy who ran the HUD account for us because he felt that we would be fired if we didn't do this. And I'll never forget saying to him, Carlton, I said, how many kids should go homeless or starve to death so that we can keep our contract? You know, it was one of the great examples of how you can lie with a, you know, you can kill with a pen just with the assumption you made. And so sure enough, we got fired and they put together a budget that basically never provided for the vouchers and other services. And so, you know, millions of people found themselves, or hundreds of thousands of people found themselves out on the street with no welfare and no housing all at the same time.
They got around that when they push for the asset forfeiture, because they can seize your assets. They can kick you out, and you're not even. It's very similar to what they did to you. The asset forfeiture, the way that you the government came at you was not directly; it was indirectly. And so, that's what happens to these folks.
Right.
I'm sitting on your stoop. I walk away. The police stop me and just say they find some drugs or a weapon on me. They say, and I say, well, hey, where are you coming from? Well, I'm coming from Catherine's house. Where she lives? Right there. So now you're targeted, and they can take your assets, even though they don't charge you with a crime, not arrested, or and if I'm found not guilty, they don't give you. You have to file to get. Have a hearing or go through the process to get your property back, and you may not get it.
You may not get it. Yeah, there's some very famous stories of the people they threw out of assisted housing, or the people who lost their properties playing that game. And it was, you know, it was very big money. And what was interesting is if you look at who was running the asset forfeiture programs, it was the same private interests who were doing the private prisons. So let's go back to the policies. If you look at the policies that Clinton was proposing, my big concern here is you know, one of the greatest powers under the Constitution, Junius, is the power of the sheriff. The sheriff is all powerful within a county area, and even the federal government, you know, the federal government's jurisdiction stops at the sheriff's jurisdiction line. And so the feds can't do something in an area unless the sheriff says, you know, okay. So the effort to nationalize and to control the police locally is a very serious and threatening power. Because if local enforcement ultimately loses control and the local, you know, we've certainly seen a lot of federal money come towards the police. The asset forfeiture was part of that, was sort of between the justice grants and asset forfeiture, trying to get the police financially, locally, sort of loyal to the feds. But if you ever break the tie of the mayor controlling local enforcement or the sheriff controlling that jurisdiction, and instead you give control to the feds, you know, that is going to get very dangerous. And that's my concern with all of this, that what you're looking at is an op to try and justify federal policies that give them local control of the police. Because no matter how bad the police are, they're nowhere near as bad as they're going to be if the feds have direct control.
Right. And what you're seeing, this, especially about a year ago, remember, there were some sheriffs in the southwest part of the country that were in opposition to the gun-grabbing laws.
Right.
And they came out and said they were not going to enforce them. And so I believe that what we're seeing is a response to that.
It's another way to get in and get that control that you need to stop that.
Right. It's no different here. Just like if a country does not go along with their program, the leader gets demonized, he becomes the new Hitler of the day, whether it's Lebovitz or now it's Putin, or whether it was Gaddafi or whatever, and that sets up for the takeover. And so any of these individually or collectively, these sheriffs who say, no, we're not going to do this, and we want to put a halt to this bum rush of our jurisdiction and of our power, they will be demonized, and either they will you know, funnel money into their opponent's campaign, or they'll do it across the board collectively, which is what you're suggesting.
Well, you know, it's funny. Baltimore was one of the first times we went through a situation like this where I came out feeling optimistic, because the sort of immune system of both people in the community and people outside the community was much, much higher than I've ever seen. You know, it's funny. So you saw the, you know, the Bloods and the Crips come out and say, well, wait a minute, you know, here's what's happening. And you could tell from the way they did it, they understood exactly, you know, the nature of what was going down. And then, of all things, you have Zero Hedge, which is a, you know, I was in the process of writing why I thought the official story was hooey. And before I could get, you know, I could even finish it, Zero Hedge popped out one that one of their people wrote, one of their contributors wrote, that just nailed, you know, the questions of why the official story was hooey. And this is in a, you know, sort of national financial context. And so, you know, it's very, you know, 10 years ago, that would never have happened. The people who publish and run in Zero Hedge would never have been able to see the game, but now they can. And, you know, and I walked away, and then, you know, and then Clinton comes out with her speech, and the whole thing was flat. The, you know, the chairs were empty. You know, it didn't go. I think, you know, her campaign manager said, well, you know, next time let's be a little bit more careful. It was kind of like, you know, they cooked up this whole thing and the whole thing fell flat.
Yeah. Well, I think that for several reasons. The country, just like the country is war weary, the police community tension is wearing on people. And,
right.
And one of the things, when we talk about the divide and rule, when you look at the figures, to date, I think there's been maybe 500 and some murders or killings by police across the country. The vast majority of them are police killing white people.
Right.
But that does get, you don't get traction when you're trying to stir up stuff. So it's the black victims that get the traction. Now, every victim is a tragedy. And so that's not my point. My point is that the police are out of control, and the blowback because of what has happened in Cleveland and Ferguson, New York, and Baltimore, there the police have to come back and justify what they're doing. And it's wearing.
Well, but let me ask you, because are the police out of control? I mean, my impression is you had policies in New York where I would describe it as, yes, totally out of control. And you have places clearly where those policies are out of control. But I know, you know, all the police that I know personally or know of personally, you know, one, they're hardworking, they're honest, and they're scared to death. I mean, they're working in an impossible vise between, you know, all the bureaucracy up the line above them and around them is corrupt, and they're working with a population who's suspicious and scared, and it's getting more and more dangerous for all of them.
Right. That's why that whole piece where they said the Bloods, Crips, and the other gang were going to target police, they were on edge. And that is the reality of the job. You know, a lot of times, because of the hostility, because of the tension, the distrust.
Right.
And so the police have their view of it, and so does the community.
Right.
The community doesn't know who to trust. Like you
right.
said, they're reluctant to call the police because, number one, in Baltimore, if you look as of a couple of days ago, last week, there was a drop in the arrests. So they did the same thing they did in New York. They did a slowdown. Now, Baltimore, because of the high rate of drug addiction, you have a lot of the petty crimes, and so that's gonna have an impact. So imagine if the community, who's almost defenseless, because if you carry a weapon and you're to protect yourself, and I'd encourage you, Gil Scott-Heron has a song called The Gun. Get a copy of it and listen to it. It's really poignant about what's going on. And I say all that to say that the community can't depend on the police.
Right.
For whatever reason. They don't trust them. The aggressive policing has given rise to the criminalization of poor people. And if you're poor, it means it's harder to make bail. So that whole piece, and we haven't talked about the Baltimore jail, but that's a significant aspect of the problem.
Right.
You talked about the public defenders being underfunded, overwhelmed. And so we're talking about the payouts of Baltimore. You're talking about $5.8 million in the last couple of years. So there's perceptions that neither side has worked to overcome. And that's one of the tragedies.
Well, let's talk about solutions, because you know, it's real easy when you look at how bad things are to think it's hopeless. But I don't think it's hopeless. You know, I used to have a pastor in Washington who'd say, if we can face it, God can fix it. And I keep wondering when it's going to get bad enough for everybody to face it. Certainly, if you're listening to us on the Solari Report, you probably faced it. But I'm just wondering if whether or not you think that in a place like Baltimore and coming out of Baltimore, if there is happening a shift in consciousness.
There's a shift, but it hasn't gotten to the point where, say, the police can sit down with the community. Now, Rawlings Blake brought in a guy out of California, and he's made some substantive changes, particularly in complaints, and he brought in an accountability bureau and task force, and it is making a slight difference. But these issues are systemic. They don't.
Right.
You could take away the black leadership in Baltimore and put Koreans in there, and for the most part, it would still be the same.
Well, you have a general economy that's dependent on drugs and mortgage fraud.
Right. And you have police policy that says we're not going to go after the people bringing the drugs in. We're going to go after street people.
Right. Right. And so until you know, that's why I always said, everybody's always saying, I don't want to deal with the black budget. And I said, look, you know, every neighborhood is being drained to finance it. So until we can have a healthy neighborhood where children are safe, there are no solutions. You know, you've got to bring kids up right. You got to get them educated, you know, and you've got to have a fundamentally lawful society where they can have basic trust. One of the quotes up on the blog this week is from Steve Covey. You know, trust is an essential ingredient to any economy. And where you have the kind of breakdown in trust we're seeing throughout the economy, it's just slowing the economy right down to a stop. Because nobody trusts the fundamental lawfulness of the system.
Right.
It's funny. Yeah. Michael Ventura had a great quote. He said, you know, he said the South Bronx is relevant to us all because it's proof that the American civilization can't stop.
Yes, and we're seeing it. We're seeing it grinding slowly to the point that if the figures that I'm seeing, the wealth being generated, the little bit of wealth being generated by the economy is going straight to the 1%. And
right.
So at some point, the folks on the bottom of the pyramid are going to have to say, wait a minute, this is not working.
Right.
And until we're willing to have that dialogue, because again, look at what's happening in Maryland. It's white kids that are getting strung out on heroin.
Right.
It's, you know, Maryland is one of the wealthiest states in the country because of its proximity to D.C. And some of the pharmaceuticals and the government and the contractors that work for the government, the NSA and Bose and all those people that you see when you're riding up and down 40 and 95. So there's money there, but it's not being made accessible to working folks because the industrial...
Right, and a lot of that money, Junius, is not produced by creating wealth.
Right, right,
it's,
right.
It's produced by, you know, debasing the currency and issuing more government bonds. So it's what I call the negative return on investment economy. And one of the reasons, you know, to a certain extent, part of what we're watching in Baltimore is the accumulated negative karma of too many generations of negative return on investment economies.
Yeah. And we're seeing it ripple out. It's not just Baltimore. It's most of the states, a lot of the counties, and a lot of the cities.
Right.
It's everybody's trying to, you know, shuffle the chairs, hoping that they can find a chair when the music stops.
It all comes back to basics. And it's never going to work unless you follow certain basic rules.
Well, that's what's happening. We're being led astray to what I call the consciousness of debasement, where the top priority is the bottom line. That doesn't work in relationships. That doesn't work if you're trying to build a solid economy. That doesn't work if you care about people, if you care about the planet.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't even work in business. The, you know, your financial returns are a performance metric; they're not a goal. So, you know, nobody ever built a great car company to make money. They built a great car company to build a great car, and and the fact that it worked financially is proof that your customers, you know, think you are building a great car.
Yeah, so, not only a great car, but a great car that a significant percentage of the population can afford and are willing to buy.
Right.
You can have an engineering marvel, but if it's cost too much, I mean, folks can't buy it.
Right. Well, and what we've got now, what we're all facing now, is we're in the process of rolling out robotics and a whole new wave of automation and globalization. So who knows where that goes.
And I think the other part of it is what we talked about last time we met, was this transhumanism, because that's part of the negative karma.
Right.
You know, where if you pay attention to what they're showing us in their science fiction, that's where they want to go. That's their idea of futurism, where they have these cyborgs. And now they're even saying, I mean, it's getting eerie. They're talking about post-humanism.
What do you mean it's getting eerie? I think it's been eerie ever since they started rounding up innocent people and throwing them in prisons to make uniforms for the Department of Defense. I thought that was pretty eerie. So one last question, Junius. How do white people and black people talk about this? Because one of the things I've found is that they're, you know, the divide between, you know, let's go back to my old neighborhood in West Philadelphia. If you look at the, you know, the high net energy plus leaders who are white and those who are black. Back in those days, we had no problem getting together and creating conspiracies and getting things done. But now I find the divide, getting white people and black people to talk honestly with each other, it's really hard.
Well, the thing is, we have to find common ground. And the common ground for most of us are the ruling elite. And even though they're untouchable in the sense that we're not going to bump into David Rockefeller on the street, or we're not going to have access to the Bilderberg conference when you know that we're all being manipulated by them and their minions, and you can identify their minions, then you can say, okay, let's identify one thing that we can do together. You bring your resources, you come, you bring your A game, I'll bring my resources, and I'll come with my A game, and we'll see what we can do.
Right.
And you have to understand, okay, their playbook is limited. They keep running the same plays over and over and over again. So just look at, and these are the variations of the plays that they run, so let's be aware.
Right.
Because when we come at them, if you look at the history of this country, from colonial times when the poor whites, the indentured servants who were slaves themselves, the Africans and the Native Americans together, the colonial elite were petrified.
Right.
And they had to do something to break that up. And that's been their play ever since. Break it up. Whether it was the cooperative, the populist political party, the farmers cooperative, the CIO, where they were more open to black and white working together. Anytime that happened, they either tried to co-opt it, but they definitely tried to break it up. And so we have
right.
to be aware, okay, that's their play, to break this up. That's what COINTELPRO was all about.
Right. Well.
And we have to have enough trust that, okay, we know that that's their play, so let's, you know, go and give each other the benefit of the doubt and see how it works out and prepare our people for that.
Right. I also think it's really important that we proceed to always try and do things that have a positive return on investment, because I think, you know, the spiral down is over in the negative return on investment side, and it behooves every one of us, whether it's our time or money, to focus on those things that have a positive return on investment. Because if you look at the economy, the reason it's spiraling down is, you know, if something has a negative return on investment, then I need to pump it up with government money and government debt every year. But if it has a positive return on investment, it's got increasing returns. So you're making the pie bigger. And the reality is we're all behaving in ways that cause the pie to shrink. What we need is for the pie to expand.
Yeah, but there's an incentive for us. They dangle the bait, and that's the incentive
right.
for us to make the pie shrink.
Right.
Until we
right. It was always really sad to see neighborhoods. You know, you would win government grants if you could put together a more compelling case that everything was rotten. So neighborhoods would compete to, like, prove how, you know, I'm more rotten than you are. Which was ridiculous, because the spiral up, the positive is to get stronger and stronger and stronger. So it was a very negative incentive, which is why, you know, my good friend Franklin Sanders always says government money comes with a sock in the jaw. And the faster you can get away from government money, you get away from the negative return on investment.
Well, the thing is, like, people like you have to educate the rest of us how to create our own equity so we don't have to go to the government.
Right.
Nowadays, corporations, because if you look at what's happening in the black community, a lot of the groups, organizations, and people who want to do well and want to do good, they're being co-opted because they're being forced to go to foundations and corporations to
right.
get money.
Right. Right.
And see, the people that were undermined by COINTELPRO were saying, do for self. Those are the kind of people that were run out of town, or who were murdered, poisoned,
right.
or just laughed, mocked, or scorned.
Okay, well, I said about three questions ago that was the last question, but before we finish, Junius, what I would love is if you could just brief us a little bit on your show and how to find you on the internet. And then any last thoughts you have listening to this conversation, what you think each one of us should do to, you know, to overcome.
Well, you can find me, if you type in my name, Junius Ricardo Stanton, J-U-N-I-O-U-S, RICARDOSTANTON, you'll see a lot of things that come up. The program is called the Digital Underground. It's on the Rambe Radio. I'm also on the SoundCloud. You can see me. That the name of that program is called Aquaben, and you'll hear Catherine on there. I'm also, I don't do it as often, the Cyberspace Sanctuary. I'm there. You'll probably see some YouTube or Vimeo videos that I put up. And you can see me at, I have a blog, it's called From the Ramparts. There's a portal called Before It's News. If you go up there and put my name in that, you'll see some of the things I've written. And that's how you can get a hold of me. You can email me at JRSWR.
Junius? Woods?
I hear you.
Junius? You were blanked out for a second. Okay. So start again with, we can email you.
JRSWRITER@comcast.net.
Okay. And you're going to run this show on Cyberspace Sanctuary?
I'm going to run it on everything.
Okay. So maybe we get a conversation going.
Hopefully. Say, you know what? I heard something that makes sense.
Uh-huh.
I heard something that I can bring something to the table, too. Even if it doesn't have to be a kumbaya type of moment, it can be a geeky kind of thing. Like, whoa, if we don't get this together, they win. The other side wins. That's the bottom line.
I told you the famous comment I made here. I said, you know, because I live in a very segregated place. I said, you know, if you guys would just collaborate at the money, you could hate each other rich instead of hating each other poor.
Yeah. Well, but again, that what you're talking about is my solution. And the solution is metanoia. That's the Greek New Testament word for repent. Just means change your mind. Change the way you think, change what you think about, change your perception, change so that your imagination is positive and progressive as opposed to negative and defeatist, and get down to the root of what the Buddha said, in this world, hatred ceases not with hatred, only by love will hatred cease, and Yeshua said, love ye one another. It sounds corny and hopeful, but that is the only solution.
It works.
Yep.
It works.
Because it works not just for the other person, it works for you.
Yeah.
You start loving yourself and other people, your blood pressure is going to go down. A lot of the aches and pains and the stresses in your life are going to go away.
I don't know, Junius. I always get the inspiration sort of drained out of me. And then when I talk with you, I think, I can do that. Yeah, that's one of the reasons I love talking with you. I feel, okay, I can go out and love those people again.
Even if they don't love you back.
Yeah. Well, it's if you come into Hickory Valley, we've got a mural up on the side of the building with a, it's a picture of a cotton field because we're a cotton farming community with a field trial dog, hunted dog in the field. And then underneath it's a quote from Corinthians, whatever you do, do it for the glory of God. So, yeah, so you got to do it whether they love you back or not.
Yeah.
Anyway, Junius Ricardo Stanton, can I tell you something? You're the best. So I can't thank you.
Appreciate it.
I can't thank you enough for joining me on the Solari Report. And will you keep us, we're in cahoots, but keep me up to date on what you're doing, okay?
Will do.
And if we get a conversation going, let's have a webinar and let everybody talk.
Yeah.
Okay, you have a great night.
All right, you too. Thank you.
Bye.